From 90.5 WESA, I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and this is Essential Pittsburgh for Friday, March 13th. Tomorrow is Global Super Pi Day, as in the pi symbol used in mathematics to represent the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. The date of March 14th coincides with the first few digits of pi, 3, 14, 15. Today, we'll look at the growing popularity of Pi Day in the U.S. and how it's being celebrated in Pittsburgh. Also, folks often wonder about the quality of Pittsburgh's drinking water. We'll check in with a Pitt professor who's been studying the microorganisms in Pittsburgh's water with help from students at the Pittsburgh Gifted Center. And we'll talk with Guy Raz. He's the host of the TED Radio Hour, a show based on talks on how we love, why our brains like sin, and why and with whom we share secrets. This and more on today's Essential Pittsburgh after the news. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. I grew up in Pittsburgh, drinking the water that comes out of the taps. My family was not into buying bottled water. Now I refuse to drink tap water, but I've often wondered if it would make any difference if I did. University of Pittsburgh professor of civil and environmental engineering Kyle Bibby has taken that curiosity one step further, actually several steps. He's been studying the microorganisms in Pittsburgh's drinking water, and he's received some help in this endeavor from students at the Pittsburgh Gifted Center and the Carnegie Science Center. He joins us now in Studio A. Kyle Bibby, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So what inspired you to embark on this study? Did you think something needed to be done with the drinking water?
Well, first off, just off the top, I'd like to say that Pittsburgh has fantastic quality drinking water. And so if you talk about your preferred to drink bottled water, I think that there's probably no need and you'd be just as safe drinking the tap water.
So all those years growing up here drinking the tap water, those of us who did that were not damaged in any way?
No, not at all. I think, and in fact, most bottled water is just tap water that's been bottled in some city where they can purchase it cheaply and shipped here for you to buy. So I think that the tap water is perfectly safe to drink. So just off the top, PWSA does a great job treating our water. But what really inspired this project is I do work on extra treatment of drinking water, making sure that it's perfectly safe, ensuring that it's safe, and also on the infrastructure. So over hundreds of years, microorganisms in the drinking water pipes can actually eat away and corrode it, and that is what typically causes pipe breaks. And so we did that research in the laboratory, but I thought it would be valuable to extend it even further, to work with undergraduate students and middle school students so that they can get their hands-on experience with research and STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and hopefully encourage them in the future to not only learn more about water quality and microbiology, but to pursue advanced STEM degrees and advanced STEM education.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, Kyle Bibby, professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Pittsburgh, who's been studying the quality of Pittsburgh's drinking water, what may or may not exist in the water here. If you are wondering how he went about this study and some of what he has learned, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, our number, 412-246-2002. As far as you know, Kyle, is this being done around the United States?
There are similar projects that exist. This is a sort of a novel take on this idea of microbial sampling in different environments. And as a little bit of background, we like to think of water and lots of things that we eat, et cetera, as sterile, but really nothing is sterile in the sense that microorganisms exist everywhere, even in NASA clean rooms, where they work very, very hard to remove all microorganisms. And so understanding what's there is essential to ensuring that it's safe, and it's also just very scientifically interesting. And so people will look at sampling environments throughout cities and buildings, all these type of things, and it's doing it with a citizen science type approach, which is what we're doing here, where non-professionally trained scientists are actually the ones doing the sampling. In our case, it's students from the Pittsburgh Gifted Center, and then analyzed using different techniques, and we use DNA sequencing to analyze the types of microbes that are found in our samples.
How did you get the students involved?
Well, I reached out originally to the Carnegie Science Center, and I began working with them, and I'll give them a quick shout-out. They just opened their new H2O Why Our Rivers Matter exhibit, and I was able to check it out earlier this week. It was absolutely fantastic. I encourage anyone with kids or even without kids to go check it out and learn more about all sorts of different aspects of our region's water. It's absolutely fantastic, and there's a small little segment in there on our project here. And then they connected me with Tom Nash, who's a middle school teacher at the Pittsburgh Gifted Center, which is run through Pittsburgh Public Schools. And he was really, really open to the prospect of us including some of our project into his curriculum. So he already had part of his curriculum that was the unseen world and microbiology for his middle school students, and he thought it would be very exciting for them to get some hands-on experience with university-level research.
What goes into involving civilians, in this case young students, in a project of this magnitude? You spoke of how you reached out to them to get them involved, but is there extra training that the students need to go through beyond their classroom lessons?
Yeah, so we had to go through and get all sorts of permission slips from their parents and university approval. But really what is involved is us working very, very, very hard to make the sampling and communication of the science as straightforward as possible. And this past year was just our first iteration, so we need to continue to work and make it even more seamless in terms of sampling. But the students, the training is on the order of maybe 10 minutes of how to sample, and it fits right into their existing curriculum. So I think it's pretty painless for them and also pretty exciting.
And so to what extent are the students involved in gathering the data?
So they gather the actual samples, the middle school students, and then the samples are analyzed by undergraduate.
And by gathering the samples, they just go home and turn on the water?
Tap water, correct, okay. Yes. But they bring it back, and then undergraduate students at Pitt analyze the samples for different water quality parameters in the microorganisms, and then we share the data with the Pittsburgh Gifted Center and then also through the Carnegie Science Center where we have an exhibit.
And is there a different approach that you take to the research when working with students, especially the younger students?
Yeah, as I indicated, when you work with younger students as a university professor, I'm used to working with higher level students, and you can communicate and they understand what you're saying much more easily. So the challenge for this project for me has been developing it is communicating very seamlessly and cleanly with middle school students. And this has also been helped out a lot by my colleagues at the Pittsburgh Gifted Center and Carnegie Science Center, who've taught me a lot about communicating science.
We are talking about Pittsburgh's drinking water and the quality of it with Pitt Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering, Kyle Bibby. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. We'll go to the phones now. We have James in Fayette County. James, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Not sure if this was in your area of study or not, Dr. Bibby, but go ahead, James.
No, hey, Paul, thank you. Well, that's why I'm kind of a little bit mixed up. Like, Professor, you're just taking the drinking water for the Pittsburgh area. Is that correct?
That's correct. All of our samples have been within the Pittsburgh area.
Okay, so what river do you get your water from? All three rivers? There's the Allegheny. Maybe you can enlighten me on this.
Good question.
What river does the water system receive its water from?
Yeah, in Pittsburgh.
It's the Allegheny.
The Allegheny. Do you have any indication of the Ohio Monongahela? Because I'm down here before the Maxwell Locks in Brownsville, Pennsylvania. It's like halfway between you and Morgantown. I'd say about 38 miles southeast of you guys. You have any clues on that? And, Professor, thanks for being on. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for your question. I apologize. I really don't have any details outside of our specific water system here.
That may be the next step.
Yeah. That is actually the next step in expanding this project. You know, some of our findings have been interesting, but maybe not as exciting to students because it turns out our water quality is very, very good. And so the microbes we find are generally very, very safe. In fact, everything we've found has been perfectly safe to drink. And so it's not as exciting for the students. So we're moving forward to include sampling of our rivers so we could look at the water quality of our rivers as well and additional water systems too.
As you go downriver, is there any reason to believe that the water may be a little more open to hosting some of these microorganisms you're looking at?
Well, of course, any sort of contamination. So everybody down the river, their treated wastewater goes into the river, et cetera. But I think since my wife is from Louisville, Kentucky, I'm going to be forced to answer to say that we have no cause for concern there.
If you want to go home, I guess.
Yes.
So, what have you learned about Pittsburgh's drinking water and the presence of microorganisms such as viruses and bacteria? I know you haven't completed this study, but you do have some preliminary results.
Yeah. So again, this project is just beginning. We found that the water has been extremely safe. The population is generally similar throughout the city. We have found a few interesting things. In certain regions of the city, we find bacteria that are associated with iron metabolism. It means they eat iron, and that makes sense. So there's old cast iron pipes in that parts of the city. And we found different variations in different buildings where we've sampled. But if you want the details, you can check it out at the Carnegie Science Center, or we also have a website.
Something about... Did I hear you say eat iron?
That's a straightforward, simple way to think about it. So irons are bacteria can metabolize all sorts of different things, and so iron is one of them, and they cause
the
corrosion.
Eating the iron, which causes the corrosion in the pipes, what does that do to the water?
It doesn't affect the water quality necessarily. Iron wouldn't be toxic, but over long decade type time periods, it could cause pipe breaks.
Let's go to Jane in the South Hills. Jane, you have a question. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Dr. Bibby.
Thank you. A question about perhaps outside the scope of your investigation, but I hope you widen it, to chemicals that are in the water, including those sprayed on lawns and farm yards and fields and so on, herbicides, and whether they are tested for and filtered out, and also the persistent chlorine that has just been introduced into these water treatments, which in the last couple of years, which is a higher, a stronger form of chlorine. And I was wondering whether those are measured and how they could be affecting health.
It's a good question, Jane. What about her concerns?
Yeah, thank you for the question. They're definitely all relevant concerns. I will say, you know, everything I have seen and I know that Pittsburgh water quality is very, very good, including chemical water quality. I cannot answer specifically any of those questions since I'm really a microbiologist, and so I don't study those chemical questions, and it really wouldn't be fair for me to answer them without more direct knowledge.
Have you done any observations of well water?
We haven't. As I said, my original idea was to look solely within the Pittsburgh drinking water system, but we're hoping to expand it to include other water systems, including well water, river, any lakes that students may live near, et cetera.
And do you have any interactions or have you had any with the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer or even Alcosan about this study?
Well, not Alcosan. Alcosan would handle the wastewater, but Pittsburgh Water and Sewer, I have had contact with them. They are interested in our findings, and they, like I said, they treat the water very, very well, so I think that they're comfortable with the project existing, especially as it brings focus to brings focus to water quality and water as a really valuable resource.
And we talked about preliminary results. Where do things go from here as far as your plans to analyze the data and maybe publish the results?
So I think the next step is we have a student working on this project over the summer, and she's going to work on making the sampling even more straightforward so that students can we had some challenges. Some students, our original sampling was a little bit challenging, and expanding the project. And we're hoping next year to be able to involve even more students. So this year was our first year we were able to only involve a subset of the students that wanted to. So next year we want to bring on the order of 50 or 100 more students to be able to be involved.
Well, it's a fascinating study, and we'll be interested to hear more of the results. We've been talking with Kyle Bibby, who is a University of Pittsburgh professor of civil and environmental engineering, and he's been involved with a project involving students studying the quality of Pittsburgh's drinking water. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For the last several years, the popularity of so-called Pi Day, March 14th, or 3.14, has been growing in the United States, and Saturday will mark what many are calling Super Pi Day, where we can add the next two digits of the mathematical supernumber. 90.5 WESA's Mark Neutbar spoke to University of Pittsburgh math professor Brad Ehrmantraut about both kinds of pi and the future of math.
Let's start really basic for the math challenged among us. What is the number pi?
Okay, it's really easy. Okay, you know what a circle is, and you know what the circumference of a circle is. That's the distance around the circle, and the diameter, you know what the diameter is. So the ratio of the circumference to the diameter is pi.
And that number comes out to be what?
Well, it's 3.1415926, and then I don't know more digits than that. I know there's a kid down the street that knows 40 digits, and there's some people that know a lot, and I think they've calculated about a trillion of them, but it goes on forever. It's what's called an irrational number because the digits never repeat themselves.
So why is it important that we have this multiplier, that we have this number?
Well, because any time you have anything to do with a circle or a sphere, you know what a sphere, a ball, anytime you have anything to do with that and you want to make any measurements of it, its volume, its area, its surface area, pi is involved. Pi is maybe the third most important number in all of mathematics.
All right. Well, what's the top of the pops then?
A zero and one.
Those are pretty good, yes.
And then I guess, you know, mathematicians would argue the other big number in that group is E. And there's a nice relationship between E, pi, and I, which is the square root of minus 1. That's another important one, too. I forgot about that one. But anyway, those are all important ones. But pi is definitely right up there.
So as a child, I was taught this number. I've never memorized it out to 40 digits. But, you know, I have this number in my head. How did it come to be? Who figured it out the first time?
Well, I mean, anytime people, for example, a circular area is the most efficient use of a fence, right? If you want to have a garden and you want to have the maximum amount of area with the minimum amount of fence, you use a circular garden. And so I guess way back people needed to figure out how much fencing or anything else, I don't know what they used it for, how much fencing you needed to encircle an area. And you know, it's easy to measure the diameter, but to measure the circumference, you needed to figure out some sort of way to relate the diameter to the circumference. And the Babylonians had it to a couple of decimal places, and so did India back, you know, several thousand years ago. And so people have been trying to get better and better approximations of it since. I mean, I think, you know, you don't need a trillion digits to do like Archimedes, he found a pretty good approximation. It's the one that we learn in school. I think 22 divided by 7 was sort of three or four decimal places. So we learned that. Remember, that's an approximation. If you don't have a calculator that actually has the pi key on it and you don't remember anything. And Archimedes figured it out by making successively finer polygons. So he'd start with a square and then a hexagon and so on. And with a 96-sided polygon, he worked out pi to a number of decimals. Now I think it's more just like a parlor game among computer scientists and things. I don't know how good a trillion digits are, but...
Yeah, that really does take me to my next question. Why are people still so fascinated with this number?
Well, actually, it's an interesting problem. I mean, and so it does lead to some interesting algorithms and computational methods to do these things. So I guess the computations involved and things like that can be useful for other things, I think.
Now, you use the word the pi button on your calculator. Do you think that's enough for students these days? Because they all have that pi button now. It's on their cell phone, if nothing else. Or is it important that we understand some more of the math behind it?
Well, I, of course, I'm always going to say it's better if you understood what it meant, but but you know, people don't really. How deeply do people understand a lot of things we do in mathematics? They know formulas and things like that, and that gets them by. It is a pretty cool number, and unfortunately, I think the U.S. is the only one that can ever have a pi day. Because, you know,
because we've read it the wrong way.
Well, everybody else in the world writes the date, then the month, and of course, they're 31-4 doesn't exist. There is 31 days in April, except maybe leap April. I don't know.
So you will be celebrating it a little bit at least.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, is it more okay, forgive this word if I offend you in any way, but is it more okay to be a math geek these days than it was 20 years ago?
I think so. You know, I mean, you know, we don't get concussions. So I think it's fine to be a math geek nowadays. Certainly, you know, everybody is into tech, right? And everybody appreciates that. So it's certainly more reasonable to be a tech geek than it used to be. I remember when I was in the Mathletes, we had a cheer that involved pi, so we always knew it to at least 6 or 7 decimal places.
Do you still have that cheer on you?
Yeah, it was e to the u du dy f of x cosecant I tangent secant cosine sine 3.14159. So.
That's beautiful. I'm sorry. You really tickled me with that one.
So it's got a lot of it's got a lot of math geek stuff in it, but yeah.
Now, there's a little bit of a movement underway to get rid of pi and make it something else.
There's tau, yes. Yes, which is 2 pi, and it would make things more convenient for calculations.
So we look at this number, and it's something that's been studied ad nauseum nearly. What is math science today? You guys are still doing research.
Oh, yeah, we do. Yeah, math is more important than ever. I mean, think of your cell phone, okay? You've got a cell phone, and you've got to encrypt things in it. You want to make sure that when you do a bank transaction that it's secure, and that involves cryptography, and cryptography is just really applied number theory, and people are still trying to come up with better algorithms for securing their business, generating lots of simulations and things involve computing better random numbers. I mean, there's no real random numbers out there unless you go out into the atmosphere and collect random radiation and stuff. But so that's another place where the math itself is fairly abstract, but the implications are very useful from a practical point of view. Myself, I do lots of stuff applying math to biology. I'm interested in how you can explain rhythms in the brain and things like that. There's other people that are interested in studying cognitive stuff from the point of view of using mathematics to understand the activity of the brain when you see an image. That there's people that study, and then of course there's the pure math. I'm an applied mathematician, so I can't speak for the pure guys. But what's astonishing to me is even the most abstract stuff is starting to have more and more useful applications in real world stuff. So there's plenty of new research going on, and it's still a very exciting area to be. You know, it's a very exciting field to be in. You probably don't know this, but the math major is probably the best major you can have in all the majors out there. So, terms of future potential earnings and so on. So,
yeah, because that applies to so many different things in your mind,
you can
at least.
Yeah, use it for, you know, banks need mathematicians. With so much big data out there, biologists, there's all these interesting new ways of looking at data. There's trying to automate classification of things. I mean, there's so much data coming in now that you need mathematicians and quantitative types to make sense of it.
So when our sons or daughters are doing their math homework and they say, when am I ever going to use this again, can we have them call you?
You can have them. Let's see. I'll say no on that. They don't teach math so much with the excitement that really is there. I mean, you know, you learn a lot of rote, I mean, I learned rote multiplication. We all learned that. And, you know, you learn this stuff, and it's taken out of context, and I think that's the problem. Because it really is a beautiful field.
When I think about math and nature or art coming together, I think of Fibonacci's sequence.
Oh, yep.
So,
yeah.
What, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8,
yep.
13, and on like that.
I was talking to somebody about Fibonacci. I was talking to a woman the other day that says that she uses Fibonacci numbers in her knitting patterns. And of course, the cross-sectional area, you know, the Nautilus, the one that's famous for that,
the shell.
The cross-section of that thing is the ratio of the areas of the chambers is a Fibonacci sequence.
Are there other math sequences like that that you are seeing in nature?
Well, the Fibonacci one's the most famous one, and that shows up. The Fibonacci-type sequences show up a lot in something called phyllotaxis, which is the arrangement of, like, flowers and pine cones. But there's lots of sequences that are very useful, but I think the most famous one is the Fibonacci one, of course, because it's the ratio of the Fibonacci numbers goes to that famous golden mean that the Greeks so loved. You know about the golden mean, right? About the most aesthetic shape of a building or a rectangle or architecture thing is the ratio of the height to the width is a particular number.
Right. Now you always think of the Parthenon. I think that's...
Yeah. And that turns out to be the ratio of Fibonacci numbers as you get bigger, as you let the sequence go farther out.
Well, I could go on for days, but I don't want to take too much of your time. Is there anything else that you would add about the magic of pi?
I'll say two things. First thing is, if it could even evoke a slight interest in mathematics, more power to it. And then if it also makes it possible to eat lots of pie, I think that's another positive aspect.
Thank you very much for your time. Have a great day.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
WESA's Mark Neutbar speaking with University of Pittsburgh math professor Brad Ehrmantraut on the eve of Super Pi Day, or 3-1-4-1-5. More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Saturdays at 3 and Sundays at noon, WESA brings you the TED Radio Hour from NPR. As you know, if you're a regular listener, each TED Radio Hour episode is based on talks given on the renowned TED stage and critically examines a shared human experience, how we love, why our brains like sin, why and with whom we share secrets. Produced collaboratively by NPR and TED, TED Radio Hour debuted as a 10-episode pilot season in 2012 and was recognized as the best new audio podcast of 2012 in iTunes year-end best of lists. The host of the show is Guy Raz. He's reported extensively from all over the world, and he served as the bureau chief for NPR's Berlin and London offices, as a weekend host for All Things Considered, and has taught at Princeton, Georgetown, and George Washington University. Mr. Raz was named host of TED Radio Hour in early 2013. He joins us now by phone from Washington. Guy Raz, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
You worked as a foreign correspondent for 6 years and reported for many different countries before settling back in the United States. How is hosting the TED Radio Hour different from your work as a correspondent, and do you see any similarities?
You know, the show it's very different. I mean, the show is about ideas, and I think the biggest difference between what I did then and now is, of course, I just don't really deal with the news. I mean, I love the news, and I love being a consumer of news, and I love news stories, but I think one of the things that makes this experience so different and in a sense, I guess, a little bit more liberating is that news can be very divisive. When I was overseas and I would cover a story or a conflict, you interview people who are really understandably enraged or upset or feel a sense of injustice. And what I've realized, what I've come to realize working on this show for the past 2.5 years is that, I mean, this is going to sound really new agey, but we are a species. We are a primate species. And there are many basic things that are the same about us. How we interact with happiness, how we collaborate, how we love, how we're deceptive, how our brain works. And it's those things that have made this so fulfilling. It's obviously the biggest difference with what I used to do. But I think at the same time, speaking with people, having conversations with people, which is something I've done ever since I began working at NPR as a reporter, you make a connection with somebody, and that connection sort of comes through on the radio. Like the connection that I make with somebody when I'm interviewing them, my hope is that people listening in Pittsburgh or wherever they're listening to in the country can make a connection as well and can feel something about that person that's intriguing or likable or maybe not likable, but that they can sort of take something away with that experience.
The contrast here is, as opposed to being in a foreign country and looking at some issue that's dividing people or on which people are taking sides, you're talking in this show, in the TED Radio Hour, about concepts that we're universally interested in.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think we're at this kind of moment in our culture where people respond to ideas. People are responding to narrative and storytelling, for sure, but also just to ideas, not only to news. News is hard. When news is important, we have to listen to the news, we have to watch the news and read the news, because it helps us make decisions as citizens. But the news can be tough. We hear about ISIS, and we hear about brutality and injustice and war. And sometimes, you know, I don't know, I feel like with our show, we're able to talk about things like the source of creativity. What is it that makes people compassionate? How can we be more compassionate? It's not designed to be preachy. It's not a show that says, hey, you should be like this, or you're imperfect, or you're doing it wrong. The point of the show is that we are all imperfect. We are all flawed, and we just don't really talk about it that much because we're not programmed to do that, you know? And I kind of feel like there's a place to have a bigger conversation about who we are as a species. And that's really what the show is about.
With the TED Radio Hour being an adaptation of segments and speeches that are also available online, often spread through sites like Facebook and Twitter, talk about how social media impacts the way you approach creating the show.
What's amazing to me about social media, and something that I didn't experience as a foreign correspondent, or even really as the host of Weekend All Things Considered, it's just really exploded, certainly with Twitter and micro-social media in the past few years, but we are literally able to see who's listening to us. We are able to see who's interacting with us. You know, the show is broadcast on 540 stations in the United States, but then we're also broadcast in 14 countries around the world. And then, of course, now, because everybody has access to the internet, people listen to us through iTunes or through other digital outlets. And we literally see tweets from people about a show from Lebanon and Iran and Syria, Israel and Egypt, countries that you just can't imagine that people can come together around a common theme or idea. Pakistan, India, it's absolutely incredible. And I think that's been one of the biggest things for us is when we have seen how many people are listening to us overseas, it's really changed the way we have thought about the show, because a lot of the content that we do on NPR we think of as very American-centric. And so there are even references, even like when you talk about a cultural signpost, you might say, oh yeah, you know, this week on Modern Family, or you might say something that all Americans would just know. Oh, the Bell Tower shooting at the University of Texas in 1966, something. We sometimes pause and have to remember that actually a huge number of people listening aren't familiar with those cultural touchstones. And it's actually really been interesting to think about that. And social media has had a huge impact on that.
Who has been your favorite speaker that you've featured on the program so far?
I mean, my favorite speaker, it changes a lot. I mean, there's so many talks that I absolutely love and that have had a huge impact on me. I mean, the one I come back to again and again is Amy Cuddy's talk. Amy Cuddy's a professor at Harvard Business School, and she gave a talk about body language and research she's done looking into body language and how the way you hold yourself, your own body, can have a huge impact on your levels of confidence. She talks about a phenomenon that I think a lot of people experience that we don't talk about a whole lot, this idea of feeling like a fraud, feeling like you don't belong or that people are going to find you out, you know, and I think it's something that's really common. You know, she talked about feeling that way as a professor at Harvard, that one day someone's going to find her out that she doesn't belong there, only to discover that this is a phenomenon that affects so many people. She's done research on presidents and prime ministers and great CEOs, and this is a common theme. And it's so inspiring to understand that, you know, to realize that so many people are like you.
Do you find yourself relating to a lot of this? Not that you're a fraud guy, but when you're standing in front of a class of students, say, up at Princeton, do you ever identify with those kinds of feelings of, how did I get here?
Oh, every day. every day when I walk in through the doors at NPR. You know, I've been here for 17 years. I left for 2 years to go work at CNN back in last decade. But I came here as an intern 17 years ago, and I look around me at the people I work with, and I think, what am I doing here? How did I get here? How did I get to do this? This is crazy all the time. And it doesn't change, by the way. You know, I'm a dad with children, and I've got to, like, be responsible, and they've got to, you know, earn a living. But that feeling doesn't go away. It's easier to manage it, and you sort of begin to understand that it's a normal feeling to have. But it's definitely a feeling that sort of comes and goes, for sure.
Your Twitter bio describes you as a dad who also does radio. Do you think the fact that you're a father impacts? I'm sure it does. So the question is, how does it impact your approach to producing the show?
We all have several identities, right? So I'm a journalist, and I'm an American, and I live in Washington, D.C., but I was born and raised in Los Angeles, and my parents are immigrants. But really the one that I think is the most powerful is just being a dad. I mean, that's the one that has, for some reason, that's the one that I just come back to. I'm all those other things, too, and they influence the way I think about my life and the show and my day-to-day work. But being a dad is... it's given me something. It's quite intangible. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I know that it's there. It's this feeling of understanding that your life is no longer really about you. It's about this other thing. It's about now creating the next cycle. It's like creating these creatures who are dependent on you, but your job is actually to push them away, which is very difficult. But if you don't do that, you're not doing it right. And that, to me, is one of the it is the most interesting thing that I have ever done in my life, is to raise two boys.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Guy Raz. He is host of the TED Radio Hour on NPR. As a journalist, you have profiled dozens of world leaders. You've covered varied topics like the early 2000s presidential primaries, the Iraq War, before you began hosting All Things Considered, and now the TED Radio Hour. Is this the quintessential gig for you? And how long do you see yourself doing it?
I never could have imagined I would be doing this. I could never have imagined I would leave the world of news, because that was what I did and what I loved. And this was kind of a risk, and wasn't really sure if it was the right thing for me. But it was very soon after we started this show, we created this iteration of the TED Radio Hour, that I understood it was exactly the right thing. It was my home. So I see it as absolutely the most interesting thing that I have ever done as a professional journalist or broadcaster. Will I do it forever? I don't know. It's hard to know. I mean, I would love to, but you just don't know. You know, you never know if people will get tired of the show one day, or if we'll get tired or move on. We just don't know. I mean, I love it. It's so incredibly gratifying. I get to work with producers, some of whom I mentored, who came to NPR's intern, some of whom mentored me when I was an intern. It's an amazing team. It's a small group of us who work so well together collaboratively to produce this thing that we all love, and we all really feel a sense of ownership over.
The TED Radio Hour initially existed as a 10-episode pilot season before it was then expanded into a weekly series. So once you knew that you were going to be bringing this to the air on a weekly basis, how did you consider the way that you would expand the scope of the series?
It was actually a lot easier than I even thought it was going to be, because there are thousands of TED Talks, and there's so much incredible content to mine. And every single day, there's new content added, new ideas added. We're working on a show now about numbers. And as you know, Paul, you don't talk about numbers on the radio, because it's hard for listeners to absorb numbers. Numbers are visual. It's a challenge we took on, and it's turning into one of the most incredible episodes, because numbers and algorithms shape every single part of our day and our lives, and we don't know it. They're invisible, but they are all around us. Whether you order something from Amazon, or get a plane ticket, or get an Uber, or the way your gas is delivered to your house and your water, it's all controlled by numbers and algorithms. And so those ideas are endless. It's just common. Out. I mean, I've got crazy whiteboard in my office that looks like something out of A Beautiful Mind or something, like a crazy scrawlings everywhere of just all these ideas and shows that I want to do, and arrows pointing in different directions. You know, it's like a fire hose. It just comes out, and we can just collect these amazing talks and kind of piece them together and figure out what's going to work around a theme.
What kind of feedback do you get? You mentioned there's worldwide following that you have for this show. I'm imagining you get all sorts of interesting responses from people. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, some pretty amazing things. Things I've never experienced as an NPR host in my life until I became the host of the show. People who've written in about how hearing a story about brain surgery and epilepsy, and we had a parent write in about how that really just revolutionized the way they're thinking about their child, and people who've written about how hearing a show has forced them to take stock and think about what's important. I had a mother write in about a month ago, and her 7-year-old daughter was a crazy, like, obsessed listener and asked if they could come to meet me in Washington, and they did. And we had a whole day at NPR with this 7-year-old who was amazing, you know, and it's just to think that, like, she's inspired. She wants to be a scientist. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a science person. But the idea that there's a 7-year-old who hears our show, which deals with science, a lot of science, is inspired to go into science from the show that I host is an amazing feeling.
The TED Radio Hour airs on 90.5 WESA, Saturdays at 3 and Sundays at noon. We've been talking with the host of the show, Guy Raz of NPR. Guy, great talking to you. Thanks for spending some time with us here on the phone from Washington.
Thank you, Paul.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Beginning this weekend, you'll see a lot of wearing of the green as St. Patrick's Day celebrations get underway. And of course, there's a parade in Pittsburgh. But if you can't make it to the Emerald Isle, contributor Elaine LaBom, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town, is here to tell us where you can enjoy a bit of Ireland right here in the good old U.S. of A. Elaine LaBom, welcome back and top of the afternoon to you.
It's great to be here, Paul.
All right, new girl, we're talking traveling with an Irish vibe in mind ahead of St. Patrick's Day, and you're going to try to convince me, and I'm willing, that we don't necessarily have to travel to Ireland to get in the spirit of things.
Well, traveling to Ireland isn't in the cards for everyone, so some of us will celebrate St. Patrick's Day, which is a much beloved holiday across the pond as it is here in Pittsburgh and environs somewhere in the U.S. And, you know, the fact that we have a large Irish population in this country certainly helps to keep the holiday alive. It keeps the culture and the traditions alive. I mean, you think of Irish dance, say, and how popular that is in Pittsburgh. So, you know, with that, and sure, there's, you know, there's the beer and there's all sorts of other revelry, you know, that we enjoy, you know, toasting to Ireland and St. Patrick. So there are lots of good opportunities in Pittsburgh, but elsewhere around the U.S. as well.
So you always have a top five list of one sort or another. And so the suggestions this week, first up is a host of Irish bars across the U.S. that are worth a visit.
Now, this would be a long list, and goodness knows we don't have enough time to go into all of them.
Yeah, but if you're talking to the entire United States, there might be a few.
There are many good ones, but I'll give you three that I particularly like. McGillan's Old Ale House in Philly. Don't know if you know this place, Paul.
I don't.
But it is the city's oldest continuously operating tavern. It opened the year that Lincoln was elected president, first time around, 1860.
Wow.
It's a great place. Lots of stained glass, loads of charm, you know, perfect for a pint. I love McGillan's in the Center City area, a fun spot. Another place I really enjoy, The Harp. In Cleveland, in the Ohio City neighborhood, you know, beer, wine, Irish whiskey. It's got an outdoor patio, and the weather's just starting to improve. So who knows? By next weekend, temps are going to be in the 50s here and in Cleveland. It might just be the ideal spot, just a couple of hours away. And then there is a perennial favorite, certainly for me and for many, and that is the Buena Vista Cafe in San Francisco. This is the one that's at the end of the Hyde Street cable car line. You walk into the bar, this long wood rail of a bar, and they've got the Irish coffee glasses just lined up. And you know, you splash a coffee, the Tullamore Dew whiskey, and then they just float the cream beautifully on top. The secret being that you drip the cream onto a spoon so that it creates that beautiful float. And they have mastered that at the Buena Vista. So you know what?
Somebody still takes the time to do that.
My husband does, actually.
I thought you would mention McSorley's Ale House in New York.
Oh, another good one. What did I say, Paul? It's a long list.
Yes, it is.
I mentioned my favorites, but there are many.
Now, there are a number of cities that represent when it comes to all things Irish. Pittsburgh being one of those, but we're talking travel here. So what other ones do you have in
mind? All right. Well, you know, at the top of the list, and hopefully the snow will have melted by the time of the St. Patrick's Day parade, is
everywhere
Boston.
But Cleveland, I hear.
There you go. Boston, not sure what's going on there. 8 feet of snow. But, you know, I think about Southie and even the South Shore of Boston, where my late mother-in-law is from. You know, just those communities are just, you know, just filled with Irish charm, still Irish residents. Actually, I think of the top 20 cities with Irish populations in the U.S., 16 of them are in the South Shore of Boston, led by Scituate. 50% Irish heritage, but Duxbury Hall. So you go anywhere in the Boston area, just great Irish vibe, and that is a great place to spend a St. Patrick's Day. I've spent a few there. Lots of fun. Providence, Rhode Island, not far away from Boston, a university town, you know, very artsy, very hip, you know, they got the Celtic-themed clubs and, you know, pubs and restaurants. Yeah, it's a small, accessible city. It's always a fun spot to visit, one that doesn't
and
get a lot of
about an hour
press.
North of Boston?
Actually, south.
South, or south, right.
About an hour or so.
Directionally challenged.
There you go. And then, of course, you can go back to Philly, which we were just talking about. The St. Paddy's Day Parade is on March 15th. It's been going on since 1771. And then what you do is you go to the Commodore Barry Irish Center, and the party continues on for the rest of the weekend and probably beyond.
Did you just say that Philly has an Irish celebration that predates the Revolution?
Since 1771, in fact, I did.
Wow.
Yep.
I did not know that.
Well, there you go.
You're full of fun facts. Elaine LaBalm, who is our travel contributor, joining us here on this segment of Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So with cuisine becoming global and multicultural, it's much easier to find good Irish food and great Irish chefs in the United States. And you, of all people, would know where to find them.
Hey, we're talking about food again, Paul,
yes,
at lunchtime.
Yes, we
there
are.
You go. Well, you know, I think what you need to do here is that you need to stay in the big cities. That's where you're just going to find a broader range of good food. And it, certainly if you're looking at good Irish food, think Chicago. Chief O'Neill's pub in Chicago for the lamb stew, the shepherd's pie, you know, the bangers and mash, all terrific. There's the Black Sheep pub in Philly. I keep going back to Philly. They got the Irish on us. I love this place. Also in Center City, the Guinness Fish and Chips, you know, the shepherd's pie there, also excellent. A great little spot. Always crowded. And then an Irish-born chef that I love is Catal Armstrong, and he has restaurants in the D.C. area, and Alexandria, Virginia is where he originally put down roots in the U.S. His restaurant, Eve, is, you know, very highly regarded. But a few years ago, he opened a chip shop called Eamon's A Dublin Chipper, and I have had the fish and chips there, and they are the best I have had outside of the British Isles. They're just terrific. You go to D.C., you've got to hop on that metro and get to Alexandria and have these fish and chips. You got to do it.
I'm there. If I can find a way, because that.
Oh, they're so good.
Yeah. Now, we know that for some, it won't be truly Irish unless they get to the motherland. Dublin is certainly a world capital. What's trending there now?
Well, I get the impression that everything is trending in Dublin right now. It's just such a hot city, you know, very popular destination because of their club scene, music. You know, restaurants, everything is hopping, popping, evolving. But what I'll and it's moving quickly. What I will talk about are those things that you wouldn't want to miss on a visit to Dublin. St. Patrick's Cathedral, of course, right at the top, dates to 1191. It's the largest church in Ireland. It's a great, you know, Gothic, gray, grand structure. You wouldn't want to miss that. And then there's the Guinness Storehouse, of course. And I'm not much of a beer person, but I really likes me a good Guinness. And now the brewery no longer does tours. They actually stopped them in 1972 for health concerns. I did not want to probe that any further. But you can still do a self-guided tour at the storehouse and have a tasting afterwards. So, yeah, it's the most popular tourist destination in Dublin. Actually, I think maybe in Ireland, and that's probably not too much of a stretch. Trinity College dates to 1592. Their grads include Oscar Wilde and Samuel Beckett, so that's worth it. And if you do get over there for St. Paddy's Day, it's a four-day celebration from March 14 through 17 this year. Lights out. I'd love to hear from anyone who gets over there.
And they'll be self-guiding themselves to a few mugs of beer, it sounds like.
I bet.
The Emerald Hills of the Irish countryside are the stuff of legend, and how would you plan a trip to those special places?
Well, yeah, there's so many possible choices. I mean, I'm something of an urban girl, as you know, so I would want to have sort of an urban as well as that somewhat, you know, rural, hilly, green and quieter experience. So I'm thinking Cork in the south. So you go to Cork, you ring the bells of Shandon at St. Anne's, you know, you go to the English Market, You go to some of the high points for the city views. I think County Cork would be a lot of fun, and the city of Cork as well. And there's also Galway in the west that calls to my heart. You know, it's a young town. Many students, I think of, you know, it's the home of the Clattering, actually. Don't know if you knew that. But I think of Galway Bay oysters. Oh, my gosh, to be over there and eating Galway Bay oysters, that would just be awesome. And then you could even do a side trip to Connemara. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but I am familiar with it, to see the wild ponies. It's a lake and mountain region. There's a lot you can do then in Galway and Connemara to the west.
No matter how far off the beaten path, Elaine will find the food. She will find the victuals.
I will.
Elaine Olabom tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town. And Elaine, it's been a pleasure. Lots of great information. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you and to yours.
Enjoy and stay safe.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Enjoy all of the St. Patrick's Day activities this weekend. Until Monday, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.